So I'm Rick Hansen. This is June 25th, 2014. And what I'd like to do to start is do something I don't think I've ever done on a recording, which is to say a word about the general principle of giving or generosity in life altogether and certainly in Buddhist practice. The way this normally is communicated is a pitch for donations. So I will spare you a pitch for donations, I promise. I want to speak more generally to the fundamental idea behind what's referred to as dana, which is a kind of wholeheartedness in our engagement with life. That's the essence of it. So if you really ask yourself, what is it that you give, or what is it that you appreciate being given to you, at root, it's a kind of wholeheartedness. It's a sincerity. It's a generosity of awareness that includes the whole. It's a kind of preemptive strike of compassion and kindness that gives other people the benefit of the doubt and is not quick to presume that there's some kind of stupidity or ill will or general cluelessness that's behind what the other person is doing. And also, we give this kind of generosity through attention. I think how rare it is, particularly in our ADD culture, that we grant our attention, we surrender attention fully to another person or even a simple task for 10 seconds in a row. Flip it around the other way. What's it like to be with someone who you feel has got nothing better to do for the next 10 seconds than to be completely available to you? Is that a common experience for most of us? I don't think so. Not in ordinary life, not in ordinary business culture, families, you know. Just to be completely available, given over to the other person for 10 or 20 seconds in a row. So these are the forms of wholeheartedness. These are among the forms of wholeheartedness that are really central to the underlying teaching of giving or generosity or dana in the traditional word that is really so central to Buddhism. Certainly, there is a place for material forms of giving. You know, ringing bells, bringing cookies, making efforts, setting up the room, changing the room when we're done tonight, offering money. Great. It's all good. But the essence of it all is wholeheartedness. Coming into life, coming into relationship, coming into this moment with a whole heart. It's as simple as that. Okay. Second thing, I wanted to find out how the meditation was for you. I did a little experiment, which if you've been here fairly often, you know I rarely do, which is I usually speak briefly at 6:45 and 7 o'clock, and then I shut up until I ring the bell at 7:30. But tonight I was moved to kind of track my own meditative process and to, in a sense, talk about that with you all in a series of steps, as it were. So I wondered how those steps went. Also, if you were here last week, you probably recognized that the growing recognition of the passing nature of all experience is very, very central to Buddhist practice. Or perhaps if you received the email I sent out to my Bay Area list, as it were, that included the quotations from last week with their emphasis on recognizing impermanence. And through the recognition of impermanence, increasingly finding refuge in that which doesn't change. So that was the method behind my madness in those meditation suggestions. Any comments about them? How were they for you? Great, Lily?
I liked it. I was surprised because I usually like silence, but actually, since my mind kept running off, and as it does, I appreciated when you spoke again. It got me back on track. So I actually...
Yeah. Great. Shelley? Yeah. Yeah. How was it for you progressively? to, you know, sense the body breathing, disengaging from everything else, particularly disengaging from the verbal tract, and also letting go of past and future. Great.
Yeah. As time goes on, you know. But I think it accentuated it. Whether I like it all the time, I'm not sure.
Have no fear. No, I have to really have no fear. That's good. Yeah, I promise you, no matter how many people like it, I won't do it all the time. I'll do it rarely, actually. But think of that as a process, right? You're coming into awareness of breathing, and then you're moving to the whole body breathing. You're aware of the whole, which does good stuff in terms of the brain. Moves you out into gestalt awareness and relaxes the sense of self, right? And then from there, an increasing giving over to this moment, in part through letting go of anything else, with a growing recognition, a feeling of, a knowing of passing, impermanence. That's good practice. And as that happens, an increasingly tranquility starts to grow. Tranquilizing in the body, the mind settles, settling down, right? And then more and more just here. Kind of a process. That's accessible to people. So how was that process for you? Any insights or obstructions? Great.
Didn't interrupt, and it still deepened where I was at. So I really liked it.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Good. Great. Yeah.
I thought that was interesting that you did that. And as I kept going through it, what I realized is I came into a more spacious place, and it was as if everything around, kind of a train running down the track, and I was the placid water or something like that. But the more you said it, letting it go, everything else went around really quickly. I couldn't grasp any of it. It was kind of cool because I don't want to grasp it, so it helped me realize I don't have to grasp it. And there I sat, and if I could find that more regularly, and let it all go, maybe a gross way of putting it, and put it nicer, but it worked.
That's great. Thank you. And you, yes, please. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, appreciate that. How about the awareness of passing, which is my main subject tonight? Just experiences passing. You know, it's hard to not feel it and know it. And it's easy to conceptualize about it, right? Everything changes. Okay, whatever. It's like a fortune cookie. Oh, yeah, whatever. Everything changes. Whatever. But to actually kind of rest in, you know, the knowing of passing. How was that for you? Was that accessible at all? Was there anything that happened for you around feeling or knowing passing?
Is that what the refuge that doesn't change?
Yeah.
Being in that state?
That's part of it, yeah. I'll say more about that in a moment, but we're much as the Buddha did. He progressively encouraged the development of certain kinds of skills or certain kinds of states of being that could be stabilized, right? like being able to rest so that there's a quiet and a presence. You're present. You're here. And if you're present in here, you can't help but feel and know passing of experiences. It's not a cosmic experience. You just hear and it's changing. You know, like what's in the mind is changing. I mean, if there's a knowing of that fact in your experience, if there's a feeling of changing, you're recognizing impermanence. And as the Buddha said, that's the most fundamental basis of Buddhist practice, is the felt recognition of the transience of experience. It's that fundamental. Can you say more what you mean by that? Like, what is it about the fact of experience changing continually? And how is that fact or the recognition of that fact dismissive of human sorrow? Could you just help us understand more what you mean?
Well, I'm just trying to put these things together.
Yeah. Why is it dismissive, or can you say a little more? I'm not disagreeing, I'm just trying to...
It's the truth of suffering, and the material world is full of, is fraught with suffering, sorrow, grief, loss, tragedy, whatever, but this very impassive place of just arising and passing, is that a place, that's where we're to aspire to.
I think I understand what you're saying, and I think if I get you right, you're really getting at something very deep, which is how do we find that middle place where we recognize what's true? I mean, whether we like it or not, right? There you are. You're just sitting and you're taking one breath, and all these things are happening during the handful of seconds it takes for one breath, right? Or there you are, you're in a relationship, and you're really caught up in some viewpoint. It feels so true in the moment. And then a day later, you look back on it, and you think to yourself, man, oh man, was I hijacked by that point of view. Right? So how do we be in touch with this passing nature of experience without falling into apathy or despair or hedonism, pure hedonism? In other words, if all experiences are passing, why not shoot other people? Why not get hammered every night? You know, right? Why not kick the dog? See what I mean? Right? Is that kind of where you're getting at, or in that territory? How do we recognize the passing while still coming into life with a whole heart? And that's where it gets very interesting. What seems to happen is that as you recognize the truth of experience, you're not making up something, you're not trying to acquire, you know, a positive attitude, you're just recognizing, whoa, changing, passing, can't hold on to it, right? Can't hold on to it, can't keep it. What seems to happen is that actually people get more peaceful and happier and loving. And to use a very technical term here, recognizing impermanence does not make you a dick. All right, just saying. So if you think about it, most people who really are there, they have a whole heart. So that's how it shows up for me. And then it gets very interesting because you start to wonder, why would the recognition of impermanence, you know, take us to a good place instead of being selfish or nasty? Because you could think that logically it would make us selfish or nasty, Oh, well, impermanence. Why not get every little goodie I can, and why not just smack them down along the way? But there is, at the human level, something very kind and loving in us when we're no longer troubled by chasing after passing experiences. And also, some people take the view, in some quarters in Buddhism and more generally, and I'm among them, that there is something about the unconditioned that is always existent just before experiences stabilize and then passing away. There is something about that which is, as the Buddha put it, in that my mind delights, that is worthy of the mind delighting in, that it has some qualities to it, such as love and even bliss. In other words, as we increasingly release from our identification with and our absorption in and fabrication of, that's a word the Buddha used a lot, fabrication of experiences. As we do that, it's weird. We increasingly kind of fall out and open into, and people who are very far along in the path of awakening seem to really embody this in their own lives. We seem to fall out and open to something really beautiful and caring and wise. And along the way, you know, my mother died. I can feel right now my sadness about that. It was about 8 years ago. And that sadness as an experience is itself vibrating. It's changing. It's kind of alive. It's moving, right? It's dynamic. It's compounded. It arose because I thought of it. And it doesn't make my love for my mother any less, or my, you know, the dignity of death any less, to recognize that this experience too arises conditionally. You know? And it's made up of parts and will pass away like everything else. So they're not at all. I appreciate you bringing this up. It's so fundamental. I'm very glad. You know, and see for yourself. You know, bring it down to earth. Wow, here I am sitting. There is a knowing, a feeling of passing, the passing quality of experience. What happens then if I really open to the passing quality of experience? Often there's this intermediate step of not quite panic, but sort of like, because it's kind of freaky. It's changing so fast when you're really in touch with that. But then on the other side of that panic, honestly, just everybody who keeps going describes, you know, me included, just this like, how it, you know, I've used this metaphor, it's like you're on the 23rd floor and you want the elevator, so you push the button, you know, and we're kind of on autopilot and the doors open and you step in and whew, there's nothing underneath your feet. You know, experience is passing away so fast. And it's kind of freaky, like, whoa. But then you realize it's like there's a fountain. You know those fountains that shoot up and you put a little ping pong ball on top of them or something and it just sits there? It's like, it, you know, everything's disappearing and yet it's also simultaneously like reemerging. So we can't trust, really, passing experiences, but we can trust the nature of things because the nature of things doesn't change. Right? The even though there's an emptying out, there's also a re-arising. So this is what I really hope to explore with you tonight, is to see what questions you might have from last week or the materials I sent out, or just starting fresh, just ba-boom. This core teaching in Buddhism, it's very central, and like everything in Buddhism, take it with a big grain of salt, see if it's real for you. It's this fundamental, the core idea is that recognizing that all experiences are transient lightens us up in our relationship to them. We hold them more lightly, we get less upset by them, we get less addicted around them, and we open increasingly to a growing wholeheartedness and freedom in relationship to living and dying eventually. That's this core idea. Recognizing transience relaxes clinging, reduces suffering. It's kind of, that's the essence, really, of Buddha Dharma. Let's engage this. Yeah, in the back. That's good.
That helped me a lot, especially on the grieving part and letting go, you know, because everybody has their good and bad. It is just what it is, but it helped me be more in the center, along with your notes, by the way.
Well, that's good. Yeah, they're quotes from the Buddha, but yeah. So that's okay. So actually, I think what I'll do is read you my own couple sentences here and then see what your questions are about this. Or where you are in your own practice of this. I wrote, the central importance of recognizing impermanence. Our experiences are constantly changing, and most of material reality is continually changing as well. Through a deepening felt insight into impermanence, we let go of clinging to transient experiences and the suffering that comes with it. It's a pretty tight summary there, right? Through a deepening felt insight into impermanence, we let go of clinging to transient experiences and the suffering that comes with it. Plus, paradoxically, we develop a growing intuition of what doesn't change, which is the underlying nature of things, and perhaps even a something or other that is unconditioned, not subject to arising and passing away. Where are you at with this kind of core teaching? Yeah, been there, done that myself.
Yeah, but down the line, you know, there you're still just a nihilist, and where the path, and so the path you're drawn to Dharma. That's what I'm. That instead of, you know, punk rock or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And I if just one little invitation, then more questions or comments. Feeling passing. What happens when there is feeling passing or knowing passing? passing. Just breathing, you know, one breath, abiding as a body breathing, a knowing of passing. What happens then in your own experience? Particularly when the knowing of passing or the feeling of passing is prominent for you. But that's a question. Like you can get, we can get philosophical or conceptual about it, but honestly it's as simple as coming more and more into the present moment, knowing passing, and letting go. You know, Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's prime teacher and teacher of many teachers, he was asked once to summarize his whole teaching. He described it as knowing and letting go. Knowing this moment, letting go of this moment. Knowing this moment, letting go of this moment. Okay, quick hands or comments? Great, Bill and Tom.
I like what you said, and it's just to my, what came to my mind is choices. We have choices. We can choose to try these things out and let them go and not become nihilist or humanist. But we can, you know. And I don't think it matters. I don't think there's any meaning behind any of that. It's just what you do. You make a choice and you do it. But it doesn't mean anything. That's nihilism. How could it mean something? That's a philosophical question. I've heard Rick speak for about 6 years or so, 8 years, I don't know what it is. And probably, he said now, maybe 468,000 times, is not to get philosophical about anything.
Right. How present are you in this moment of experience as it passes away? That's a lot of what we do is we train the mind and the heart, and we become more virtuous so that we may become more and more present in this moment as it passes away. That's the edge of practice. Right? Where are you at with that? Yeah, Tom.
I can either celebrate it or I can grieve it.
Mm.
I can grieve loss or I can celebrate maybe in an even more accentuated way than without the concept of impermanence. Maybe I celebrate it more because it is impermanent. Your mother's life, a moment, a conversation, whatever. So that hurt me. I just had these two choices. Or celebrate it. I really can't deny and accept another philosophy that things are not impermanent, except that you mentioned. I mean, if I have a rational mind, I have to accept impermanence as something that is. So those are thoughts that came to mind.
Thank you.
It's really just two choices.
Yeah, that's, thank you.
Yeah,
oh, perfect, great, yeah. Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I just had a thought, kind of piggybacking on the woman over there was saying, about Buddhism and the way it comes across with the language of it, which is kind of via negativa, you know, kind of deconstructing the false and the effect that has on the mind when you hear it. And I think part of the problem, you know, that I experience sometimes is that we have a self, we have a relative self. And that self is like your ticket. Without that being functional and whole, you can't know the not self.
Mm.
So it's almost like the not no self impermanence experiencing that is contingent upon you having a cohesive functional self. And yet this kind of short shrift is given to that in Buddhism because it's kind of assumed you already have that and you go to the monastery, the way I see it, and you do this thing. It's like second half of life individuation or something, where you're open to this larger frame.
Yeah.
And so many of us are still dealing with wounds from the first individuation that we never kind of got.
Yeah.
And so when you hear the language, it feels like an assault. like we have these two parts. And so I think the idea is to have be able to have compassion for, you know, your conventional self, which is really your ticket to get enlightened anyway.
Super stuff. I'm very happy about this effervescent discussion. Please. Yeah, thank you. To be slightly provocative, and then I'll be briefly slightly provocative, but I mean, my own view, I guess, is that if we look closely at even those things that seem somewhat stable as sort of like standing waves in our mind, like our view about certain things or kind of the core feeling of being a body, which has a lot of stability to it, right? Even that, if you look closely, has a kind of fizzy, dynamic, somewhat transient nature in its essence. It's kind of twitchy in a sense. And I think actually, from a neuroscience perspective, precisely because or in proportion to the instability of the neurocognitive process, it's so freaky that the mind grasps after these sort of essentialized things or views or static perspectives to kind of hold on to, right? And it's up to you, but there's a lot of dharma about becoming increasingly comfortable casting loose of those familiar moorings. Now, to do that, I think just like you said, you know, it helps to have internalized, as I've taught often, take in the good, internalize resource, internalize a healing of wounds. But the point of all that, again, if you're up for this practice, this path, is to increasingly radically, which means at the root, radically means root, increasingly radically give up. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. And give up to, paradoxically, you know, this kind of extraordinary stuff that the Buddha's talking about, you know, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights, right? The sorrowless state that is void of stain, bliss. I mean, it's good news, Dharma. Okay, so think about that. Watch your mind trying to clutch to something that's stable, because see if you could become more and more open to, if you can stand it. You know, don't do this if you have a history of psychosis. But anyway, but of just this wiggly, jiggly, fizzy quality to experience, you know, at kind of its basement level. And yet, if you just relax about it and get past the freak, like, whoa, 23rd floor, nothing's holding me up, you start realizing there's a stability in the instability, right? There's a continual reemergence, and you get more and more relaxed about it always, you know, falling apart. Okay, other comments, people? Great, crazy stuff. Great, Tressa. I'm gonna go after other people, but yeah, go. Yeah. Okay, so minimally, right, you realize that the mind-brain process keeps on going as long as we're alive, So that minimally is stable. Okay so far? So even though it's all fizzing, the fizzing keeps going, right? Because we're animals. Fizzing keeps going, right? Now, at a deeper level, this is where you've got to see what your own view is. I think most people would agree, wow, experience is changing. And from a basic medical neuroscience perspective, that changing has to do with extremely dynamic neurochemical processes that continue as long as we're alive. Okay? Where it gets trippy, you got to see for yourself, is there some kind of intuition of some thing or other that is not conditioned, does not arise and pass away dependently. The ongoing fizziness of the mind-brain process is dependent upon the life of the body. When the body dies, it dies. Right? The question, and the Buddha came from a mystical tradition. That's why this is not just positive psychology. You know, his assertion, and you got to see for yourself what's true, is that in the deep nature of reality, there's some kind of underlying, reliable, unconditioned, deathless, eternal, something or other. And that's what the Buddha himself fell out and opened into and came back to talk about.
Uh-huh. And so I'm still missing the here. To me, he fell back, he walked into a shaft, elevator shaft. That is what you're describing, is what landed, is the unconditioned. Or maybe land in isn't the right way to put it. Is that not what you're saying?
What I'm saying, and I appreciate you pressing it here, how it shows up for me, and I think this is really good to keep bringing it back to your own experience. You know, how it shows up for me is when I relax, and I have to resource myself so I can do that. And I don't think I'm unique in this. I think this is a progressive path that we're on, you know. And there are markers on the path, and you start having experiences, and you realize, oh, that's what those folks were talking about, okay? So it's true for me that when I relax, in the direct experience, it feels fuzzy or fizzing. It's fizzing. It's made up of many parts. It's changing. I think this is the nature of everyone's experience who has a human body brain, right? I think your experience is like my experience because there's just one human DNA, right? So, and what happens then at this level, so for me there are two levels, Tressa. This level is where we just kind of drop out into and open into the nature of experience, which is made up of parts and changing continually and re-arising. As long as there's a heartbeat pushing blood up into the brain, feeding those little neurons so they can keep bzzz. And what it feels like, though, experientially, is it feels like you're coming deeply into your own nature. And as you do that, you look, it's kind of like there's nobody there. But there is a there. There is consciousness ongoing. You know, there are tendencies arising, sensation, sound. It's just this. And why should we do that? Why should we train? Why should we sit here for 45 minutes bored? You know, whatever, to do that. It's because in the doing of that, it feels like there's a profound coming into the truth of your own experience and a peacefulness to it. And the more seconds you kind of clock, whoo, opened out into the disconnected, fizzing, changing, micro-turbulent nature of experience. When you kind of come back, you're less of a wanker. You're more chill. You lighten up, and you're easier to live with, and it seems like good. So for me, it's like level one. And so in a sense, what you also recognize is that there's signal and noise in your own experience. Any part of experience that's stable is signal. It's a reduction of uncertainty. But in the mind-brain system, there's a growing intuition that there must be fertile noise always also there as excess capacity. So you find yourself more and more kind of dropping out of involvement with any particular component of experience. And you find yourself more and more kind of hanging in the fertile noise in your meditation or everyday life. And I think that's also what happens as you track the Buddha's own steps through the four jhanas into the formless jhanas all the way out to nirvana. It's more and more just fertile noise. It's fertile noise that's conditioned by having a body that evolved with human DNA. In a material universe. We're not yet in the transcendental, but it's like the transcendental. It's like this fertile noise that's the necessary requirement for any kind of pattern or signal to emerge in the mind-brain process. You get what I'm saying? In other words, you have to have an empty chalkboard on which you can write things. You've got to have this fertile carrying capacity. Those neurons are firing, but they're not carrying any information yet. They're just and then sound, thought about thought. That is, in effect, unconditioned because it's not yet conditioned. It's just fertile noise. It's like the chalkboard is not yet conditioned by the picture or the words we put upon it.
That is helpful.
Yep. And that's like freaky great insight to get, wow, it's the unconditionality, the relative, the ultimately conditioned because we have a body, but inside that, this fertile noise. The blackboard is empty. Somebody built it, right? It's conditioned by material reality, like what are the component elements of it? Okay, in that sense. But inside that big frame, could do anything. It's not yet conditioned. It's like ultimate transcendental unconditionality. So I think it becomes an intuition as we recognize the kind of relatively unconditioned nature of this fertile noise, like the space between thoughts, or this sense you get to more and more when you get quieter and you're less trying to control the process and it's more chaotic and it's okay. You start having an intuition, I think, of ultimate unconditionality. And I think that's what people do. That's why they try to, in practice, you look at practice. Practice is a lot about being able to go into a zone where there's very little signal. It's mostly just fertile noise. You're not unconscious. But other than that, there's just not much happening. Right? Why would people do that? I think because it tends to make them nicer and kinder and easier, but also because it becomes an intuition of the ultimate. And then I think, in my own view, there really is an ultimate unconditionality that's woven into the nature of emergent reality. For it to actually be possible for change to occur, if you think about it. We're in the deep water, but the essence boils down to this question. How capable are you of being present in this moment as it ends, as it passes away, moment after moment after moment? That's kind of the practice, can you sink a free throw? 1 out of 10? Can you make 1 free throw out of 100 shots, right? Once a day, can you be present in this moment as it passes away? Or 1 second during meditation, can you be present in this moment as it passes away? I bet everybody in the room minimally can do that. And then you get more and more, you get closer and closer to this moment as it emerges and passes away. Then that's practice. That's available to us. It's very psychological. It's down to earth. We all do that. We all can do that. What do you think? And then we'll wrap up. I hope I'm not being too hardcore here, but whatever. Yeah.
And so if you take, and what we're kind of doing is, we're not directing our attention to the experiment anymore. We're directing our attention to the breath or something else. But it is pretty profound stuff.
Yeah, and thank you for just really wrapping up tonight. The way it often shows up is that there's a sense of the truth of this, right? And then there's the concept of the truth of this, which is no longer in the sense of the truth of this, right? That happens. And the trick is to use the concept of the truth of this, which I've been offering. I've been trying to offer pointing out instructions, they're called, in effect, pointing out. Take a look. Check it out. See what's true for you when this happens. You know, engage the natural experiment yourself from the inside out. It starts there with concept, and it's natural for the concept to arise. And then what happens increasingly is you kind of help yourself disengage from conceptualizing in this coming into the present as it passes away. Good. Okay. It's okay if conceptualizing arises. Don't freak out. But it's to disengage from it. And notice that conceptualizing, the felt recognition of transience, is not the same as the felt recognition of transience. Yeah, last person.
So you said.
It's on tape, as it were.
To have a thought about a thought. And the sort of like a split second of nothingness.
Yeah.
So earlier this week, I think it's because of something you said last week, I decided to start a practice of, is this useful in regards to my thoughts?
Yeah.
And I have post-it notes everywhere. Is this useful? Everywhere I might be thinking, I have a post-it note, which means...
You're surrounded by pointing out instructions, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
so
that's cool.
Is it useful?
Yeah.
And I have found that you've talked about 1 out of 10 times, 1 out of 100 times.
Yeah.
9 out of 10 times, what I'm thinking, in fact, is not useful. It's not good or bad. Well, sometimes it's bad. But it just plain isn't useful.
Yeah.
And the second I see it's not useful, there's that split second of what's next. Because I've cut my thought off.
Yep.
And there's like, sometimes it stretches out and it seems like there's a long pause, like I have to drive a block or more. And before... I'm again conscious that I'm having a thought.
Yep.
And again saying, is it useful? So I don't know if that's what you were...
That's a wonderful description of what I called fertile noise. That space, right?
Okay.
Like, and often it feels like that. It's like,
yeah,
right?
And kind of like going, well, what's next?
Yeah.
That thought's not useful.
Yeah.
Is the thought that it's not useful useful?
Yeah. Yeah, you can get a little twisted, but... Yeah, or yeah, like don't know. Just.
I think they should have broke your driver's license.
No, that was great. That was really, really great. That was super great. That's exactly right. Okay, that was great. So I'm going to read a little quote. It's short, and then we'll sit for a minute, let it sink in, call it a night. All right. So, here we go. Whenever and wherever one encounters, one experiences the arising and passing away of experience, one enjoys bliss and delight. Which leads on to the deathless state experienced by the wise. Or as I put it, Can you be present in this moment as it passes away? I apologize for going late, and I urge you, stay with this. You know, don't get spun out into the philosophy of it, bringing it down. This breathing, breathing, passing. You know, what happens then? Okay, great. Let's go get them.